ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ गुड वेलकम बैक Welcome also to our many students attending these classes online. We proceed today. We finished chapter 8 in our prior class, and we proceed today with chapter 11, which means you're wondering what happened to chapters 9 and 10. They're very much present in the Uddhava Gita. I mentioned at the outset of this class is that it's a large text. It's about twice the length of the Bhagavad Gita. And not all of its material is so focused on Advaita Vedanta. And so I've taken the liberty to choose several chapters that are not very relevant for students of Advaita Vedanta, and we're skipping over them. So it turns out to be a good way to study this. Of course, the text is available online if you want to study chapters 9 and 10 on your own. Then it's all easily accessible and available for you to continue. Let me just give you a brief overview of what we're skipping and why. Chapter 9, like most chapters, will have a question at the beginning or towards the beginning. Here, Uddhava asks a question of Sri Krishna about the various ways to attain moksha. So there are those who sit in caves and meditate to gain moksha. There are those like King Janaka who were karma yogis to gain moksha. Others doing various kinds of spiritual practices. So it's an excellent question. The response, however, is tailored for Uddhava. So something you may not think about. Every teacher adjusts the teachings according to the audience. Makes sense, right? But that's actually a big adjustment. Because there are many, you know, for example, I could be teaching these classes at a much more scholarly level, or at a much more lighter level. Yeah, not using any Sanskrit terminology and not referring to the verses at all. So there's a wide range of ways to teach a text, and it depends on the audience. In fact, even the subject matter depends on the audience. Here, our audience, you, the students, are those interested in a life of spiritual growth guided by the teachings of Advaita Vedanta. So that's our orientation here. When Uddhava asks Sri Krishna about different ways to gain moksha, so Sri Krishna has an audience of one, so to speak. He's just teaching Uddhava, and his response to that question is tailored for Uddhava, which means he doesn't give A, B, C, D, E, because Sri Krishna knows only one of those ways to gain moksha are suitable for Uddhava. And what he says, what he teaches Uddhava is an elaborate system of visualizations made for the sake of meditation and meditation on Sri Krishna. For example, to meditate on Sri Krishna's form in Vrindavan with a certain kind of dress, of surrounded by a certain kind of environment, surrounded by certain gopis. And Uddhava is already familiar with these gopis. And earlier in the Bhagavata Purana, he went to Vrindavan and met with all these gopis. That's a whole other story, another text, another part of the Bhagavata Purana. So that particular style of devotional meditation based on very specific visualization of Sri Krishna in certain contexts, associated with, surrounded by gopis, and etc. That's a very popular form of meditation in this Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. I made mention of that before. It's a tradition on which ISKCON, the Krishna consciousness movement, is based. And it's for them, it's really wonderful. I'm afraid for us, it's a rather long chapter, and I think we wouldn't get that much out of it. It's a little, it's quite narrow in its focus on this particular form of devotional meditation. So if that interests you, then go and study chapter 9 of the Uddhava Gita on your own. Chapter 10 is also, it's a side topic. In fact, the commentator himself says, prasangena. This is, in English, how to put it? It's by the way. So it's just kind of a casual thing that's added on, which means that it kind of sticks out. It doesn't fall in the context. The flow of from one chapter to another chapter to another chapter doesn't follow that flow, because chapter 10 opens with Uddhava asking about yogic siddhis, powers that you can gain through the practice of certain kinds of meditation. What has that got to do with what we've been studying? We've actually skipped one other chapter that had a similar orientation, and it also stuck out as not being in the flow of chapters. So we're also going to skip that chapter because after the question, Sri Krishna goes and describes a great number of yogic siddhis. He's paraphrasing chapter 3 of the Yoga Sutras. Chapter 3 is the Siddhipada, if I remember right. It's the chapter, four chapters in Yoga Sutras, and if I remember right, it's the third one that goes into all these yogic siddhis. So it, really speaking, if you want to learn about yogic siddhis, you could read chapter 10 or study Yoga Sutras. But that's really, again, that's not the focus of our study here. So for that reason, we've also skipped chapter 10. So 9 and 10 are being skipped. Leading us to chapter 11, which will seem like fairly familiar territory to you if you studied Bhagavad Gita. Because in chapter 10, after Sri Krishna opens the chapter and starts talking about his true nature as the god of the cosmos, then Arjuna asks a very important question. It goes on for several verses, where Arjuna asks, you know, you've told me who you are, but I want to know who you are fully and completely. Please tell me completely your true divine nature. And with that question, the rest of chapter 10 is devoted to the vibhuti. Vibhuti, the word has different meanings in different contexts. The sacred ash we take from the altar to Lord Shiva, that can be called vibhuti. The perhaps simplest Sanskrit word for simplest meaning of the word vibhuti is something which is glorious, something which is a splendor. And here it's used to refer to the divine attributes of Sri Krishna, his divine nature, various aspects of his divine nature. And that's what this current chapter is about. And this narration of divine traits is meant for meditation, and a very different kind of meditation. Notice I referred to chapter 9, which was visualizing Sri Krishna's form in Vrindavan, surrounded by gopis. That's one kind of meditation, a decidedly devotional form of meditation. But here, in chapter 11, there's another kind of meditation being taught. To meditate on Sri Krishna by appreciating his nature as the God of the cosmos, the creator, sustainer, destroyer, and so many other aspects. His presence enlivening every living being goes on and on. No reason for me to summarize it. we're going to be going through the chapter in some length. It's an excellent chapter. Definitely we would not want to skip this chapter. Okay. I have to get this. All right. So with that introduction, we are ready to begin chapter 11. Notice the chapters aren't named as they are in the Bhagavad Gita. Those chapter names are not part of the Mahabharata anyway. The chapter names are added by great scholars after the fact. And here these chapters have not been named at all. So they're just chapter 11. So let us proceed. Uddhava uvacha, Uddhava uvacha, Tvam Brahma Paramam Sakshat, Tvam Brahma Paramam Sakshat, Anadyantam Apavritam, Anadyantam Apavritam, Sarvesham Api Bhavanam, Sarvesham Api Bhavanam, Pranastityapyayodbhavaha, Pranastityapyayodbhavaha. So he begins I'm smiling because in another context, this might be called, what is it? Is a funny term that some people use, brown nosing? It's when you flatter someone for a purpose. I don't know, there's probably better terms for that. Anyway, I won't try to remember those terms. Anyway, so he begins before asking his question. Uddhava says, Tvam Brahma, you are Brahman, Paramam Sakshat, the absolute reality, the ultimate reality. This is not praise. It's a lead up to his question. So it's common. Before you ask a question, you want to set the context. So here, Uddhava is setting the context by saying, this I understand. I understand that you are Param Brahma. You are the absolute reality. And based on that, then he asks for more. This much I understand, I want to know more. But he continues here. O Krishna, you are the supreme reality, Brahman. You are un-adi-antam. You have no adi, beginning. You have no end. You are eternal, unborn, uncreated, unchanging. Apavritam. There is nothing outside of you. You are so vast that there's no covering, like space. Space, you can enclose the space in this room, but can you enclose the space of the cosmos? Impossible. So that's the sense of this apavritam. You are unenclosed, would be a literal translation. Limitless is a good translation here. Sarvesham bhavanam, for all creatures, for everything that exists, you are the end of the final line, udbhava. You are the excuse me. You are the source. You are the source for all beings. You are the source of the prana, protection, sthiti, maintenance, and apyaya. Actually, prana, sthiti, apyaya, udbhavaha. You can take it another way. Actually, this is kind of grammatically more accurate. You are the one who gives rise to the prana, protection of all people. The sthiti, the sustenance of all people, and the apyaya, the return of all beings at the end of time when the cycle of creation comes to an end. That you are. And
Uddhava goes on.
Ucchavacheshu bhuteshu, ucchavacheshu bhuteshu, durgneyam, durgneyam akritam, akritatma bihi, durgneyam akritatma bihi, upasate tvam bhagavan, upasate tvam bhagavan, yathatat tvena brahmanah, yathatat tvena brahmanah. Bhuteshu, in all beings, Krishna, you are, I'll give you the bigger meaning here, you are present in all beings, bhuteshu, but you are durgneyam, difficult to recognize. You are present in all beings, but difficult to recognize. Present in what kind of beings? Beings that are uccha, that are higher in the sense of sentient, and avaccha, lower in the sense of insentient. So you are present in all beings. The typical statement given in so many scriptures, from Brahmaji, the highest conscious being, the creator, the God as creator, to a stamba paryantam, to a clump of grass or a clump of dirt. This is what's often given. So everything in between, you are present in all beings, sentient beings, insentient beings, but hard to recognize. Hard to recognize in insentient things, like a rock or a table, but even hard to recognize in sentient beings. Now you might, why is it hard to recognize the presence of Ishvara in living beings, especially in human beings who are endowed with such powers? Well, Adolf Hitler in the 1930s was a very powerful being, but he, very hard to recognize the presence of Ishvara in that demonic being, and then likewise other demonic beings. By the way, I learned an interesting lesson. A year ago, or maybe 2 years ago, I used President Putin of Russia as an example, because they had just invaded Ukraine, and I got some irritating comments from someone who lived in Russia who was irritated by my statement, because they felt that the invasion of Ukraine was justifiable. I don't want to get into politics here, so I'm not going to use Putin again as an example. I think I'm pretty safe using Hitler, although there are some neo-Nazis today, but I don't think they're likely to watch my videos and make comments. So I think I'm safe using Hitler as an example of a living sentient being in whom the presence of Ishvara is durgneyam, hard to recognize. And hard to recognize by whom? Akrita Atma Bihi. And here Atma doesn't mean Satchidananda Atma. Like in many places it means mind. And akrita, he means not samskrita, means an unprepared mind, an unrefined mind. So those who have not properly studied scriptures, those who have not had the guidance of a proper guru, their minds are akrita. They are akritatma. So by such people, they find it difficult to recognize the presence of Ishvara in all things. Contrarywise means that if you have properly studied scripture, and if you have been properly taught by a guru, it's not hard to recognize Ishvara's presence in material things, not just table, not just the arm of a chair, but the arm of a Swami in all physical things. We can recognize Ishvara's presence, and in all living beings, even in the very demonic living beings, we can recognize Ishvara's presence. So it's a matter of understanding. It's a matter of understanding that, how to put it, divine beings can behave in very nasty ways. That's just a fact, something well known to us all. And the reason for that is we're endowed with free will. So we can use our free will to act in accordance with Dharma. We can use our free will to act contrary to Dharma. Pardon me?
Yeah. I would expect it to. Okay.
I think it's some, this is a wireless microphone. There's some problem with the system. So, where is that thread? You have to find that thread again. Anyway, I think we're done talking about this topic. You can recognize divine beings given free will, being able to act in consonance with Dharma, being able to act contrary to Dharma, but still there are consequences. It's not an excuse to say Bhagavan gave me free will so I can do whatever I want. Well, there are consequences for what I do. If I do harmful things to others or to myself, I suffer and others suffer the consequences of those deeds. So, with that in mind, divine beings are capable of such things. Can I remind our audience not to be using cell phones in the hall? All right. So, we, akritatma bihi, durvigneyam, durgneyam, difficult to recognize. Then, go down to the last line. Brahmanaha. Here, Brahmana doesn't refer to members of the caste. In fact, many times the word Brahmana is used to refer to a wise person. Remember, of course, in ancient India, Brahmanas were, frankly speaking, the only ones to receive a good education. Shudras didn't receive education. Vaishyas were too busy with in the fields and in the marketplace. Kshatriyas were too busy defending the kingdom, so forth. So Brahmanas were just functionally the only ones who were blessed to get a good education. Something we take for granted. Yeah? Yeah. Just reflect on that, please, just for a moment. So many people in the world are denied the opportunities for education that we've all had. And that education has been so crucial to the life that we live, to the quality of the life that we live. So let's not take that education for granted. So here, Brahmanaha could be members of the caste, but there are people who are highly educated, people who are wise. In some contexts, Brahmana means those who know Brahman, those who are enlightened. That's another meaning of Brahmana, and that meaning actually works here. So if you take Brahmana here as those who know Brahman, those who are enlightened, those Brahmanas who know Brahman, upasate, in the third line, they meditate tvam, on you, Bhagavan, O Krishna. Those enlightened ones meditate on you, yathatatvena, as you truly are. Now compare this to the visualization of Sri Krishna in Vrindavan. I mentioned that after the Bhagavata Purana was written, so much devotional literature came up later. And a lot of that literature is in Bengali language. A lot of it is in Sanskrit. And it all describes Sri Krishna in various scenarios, scenarios which are basically made up. And made up doesn't mean... Great poetry is made up, right? Great literature is made up. great novels are made up. Tolstoy, made up stories. Nobel Prize winners, made up stories. Rabindranath Tagore, made up thousands of poems and songs and a lot of plays, dramas. These are made up. To say they're made up, is that an insult? It's not an insult at all. It just means that these were incredibly creative people who devised these wonderful, wonderful pieces of literature. And this devotional literature, which came up after the Bhagavata Purana, the literature in Sanskrit, literature in Sanskrit is attributed largely to the disciples of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and those who came later in that tradition, and then the Bengali, great Bengali bhaktas, so a lot of that in the Bengali language. But to say that it's made up in the sense that poems by Rabindranath Tagore are made up. They're wonderful, creative compositions, full of meaning. They would say full of rasa, full of emotion, and in such a way that you get inspired reading that material. So that's what was skipped over back in chapter 9, which we didn't study. But here, we're not going to be... Uddhava here is referring to Sri Krishna not as described by all that devotional literature, but rather Sri Krishna yathatvena, as you truly are. So the reality of Sri Krishna, not some kind of poetic description of Sri Krishna chasing gopis around in the forest and so forth. Okay, let us proceed. Yeah. Yeshu yeshu cha bhuteshu, yeshu yeshu cha bhuteshu. Bhaveshu, yes. Bhaktya tvam paramarshayaha, bhaktya tvam paramarshayaha, upasina prapadyante, upasina prapadyante, samsiddhyam tadvarasvame, samsiddhyam tadvarasvame. Start in the second line, and paramarshayaha, parama rishi, becomes paramarsha, and here paramarshi. Here paramarshayaha, plural. The great rishis. What about those great rishis? Third line, upasinaha. They meditated. They meditated on whom? Second line, tvam. They meditated on you, Sri Krishna, bhaktya, with great devotion, and they meditated on you, yeshu, yeshu cha, bhaveshu, in many forms, in many beings, in many ways and manners. They meditated on you in many ways, and prapadyante, we're jumping all over the place here, in the third line, prapadyante, by meditating on you, they gained. Prapadyante, what did they gain? Samsiddhyam, perfection, liberation, moksha. They gained moksha by meditating on you, Sri Krishna, in all these many ways, in many forms, you could say. Again, these are ways, yathatvena, charasi, you who are bhutatma, you are the self of all beings, and as the self of all beings, you charasi, you move about gudhaha, hidden. This is not your, almost the same pronunciation, I think, gur, your brown sugar, is that it? We're not talking about brown sugar here. This is gudha, it is hidden. So you move about hidden in all beings. You can get that, right? When we finish this class shortly, Sri Krishna is going to walk out that door hidden inside of you. That's what he's saying. Uddhava is making this very profound observation. Sri Krishna is present within us all, and charasi, you move about gudhaha, hidden within all beings. Not only hidden within, I'll give you the little preview of the second half. Sri Krishna moves about, residing within us, and further, Sri Krishna sees the world through our eyes, so to speak. It's a metaphor, right? So Sri Krishna is all-pervasive, so he's not only within us, he's also outside. But metaphorically speaking, this particular perspective is Sri Krishna is that inner divinity dwelling within us who, charati, in this case, he moves about, and pashyati, he sees. He moves about in our bodies, he sees with our eyes, and this is with the reference in the second half. He says, natvam pashyati bhutani, but all those beings, pashyantam, you who see everything, natvam pashyanti bhutani. All those beings, napashyanti, do not see twam, you. All beings, like you and me, Sri Krishna is looking out through our eyeballs and therefore not seeing Sri Krishna. Which is why the whole orientation of Vedanta is to turn our attention within. This whole process of being extrovert, our focus being on the world around us, is the biggest obstacle to spiritual growth. As soon as we turn our attention within, everything changes. Everything means everything. But the bhutani, those beings who are mohitani, te, who are confused about you, they na tvam pashyanti, they do not perceive you, abiding in all beings and looking out through the eyes of all beings. Then, wrong button, wrong way. How many ways can I do this wrong? There are one, two, there are four buttons on it, so I have ample scope for confusion. All right. Now we have a different meaning, a different meter in this last verse of Uddhava's question. Ya kasha bhumau divivaya rasayam, ya kascha bhumau devi vairasayam vibhutayo dikshu mahavibhute, vibhutayo dikshu mahavibhute, ta mahyama khyahyanu bhavitaste, ta mahyama khyahyanu bhavitaste, namami te tirtha padangri padmam, namami te tirtha padangri padmam. Yaha kaha, and then drop down a line, vibhutayaha. Whatever, yaha, kaha, whatever, vibhutayaha, vibhuti in plural, whatever glories of yours, of you, Sri Krishna, whatever are your glories, those glories which are bhumau, here on this planet, earth, or divi, up in the heavens, or whatever glories are prasayam, I'm laughing, in hell. So Sri Krishna is all pervasive. How do you prevent him from being present in hell, right? This is the idea. So all of your glories, which are present, bhumau, on the earth, divi, in heaven, rasayam, in hell, dikshu, and in all possible directions, about those glories, mahavibhute, Sri Krishna is addressed by Uddhava with this term, O source of divine splendor, if I were making a translation, O source of divine splendor, taha, all of those vibhutis, which are, end of the line, anubhavita te, those divine glories which are anubhavitaha, it's a, for our Sanskrit students, causal, which are made manifest, te, by you or of you, those glories which are manifest by you, mahyam akhyahi, akhyahi, tell, mahyam, me, please tell me your divine glories. Almost like Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna, where Arjuna asks, please tell me your divine glories. Namami te, I bow down to you. Tirtha pada angri padam padmam. A little bit of nice poetry snuck in here. Angri padmam, lotus feet. Lotus feet, which are tirtha pada, which are the places of divinity throughout the world. Your lotus feet are worshipped at all divine places throughout the world. Please, please tell me what are your glories, the glories which you have manifested. And we'll just begin. It goes on for quite a while. We'll just begin. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. And I shouldn't use the Bhagavad Gita melody. I keep doing that. Not a pretty deeply entrenched habit. Evam etadaham prishtah, evam, oh, I'm sorry, here we go, listen. Evam etadaham prishtah, evam etadaham prishtah, prashnam prashnavidam vara, prashnam prashnavidam vara, yuyutsuna vinashane, yuyutsuna vinashane, sampatnyar arjunena vai, sampatnyar arjunena vai. So he answers Uddhava and he says, aham, I was prashtaha, prishtaha, not prashta, I was prishta, I was asked, evam etat prashnam, this very question. And this question about the many vibhutis in which I am manifest in the world, in the heavens, and in all directions. The question which you have asked was asked before. Can you guess by whom? Look at the third line. Yuyutsuna. By the warrior. Which warrior? Not any warrior. And by that warrior, Arjuna, I was asked the very question in chapter 10. You might want to go home and review chapter 10. It's wonderful, and it will really help you understand this chapter. So I was asked the very question by Arjuna, Vinashane, during the battle. Here, Vinashana is the destruction. referring to the battle, Mahabharata. It was asked by Arjuna. In fact, Arjuna's name comes at the end. Sapatnyaihi Arjunena, Yuyutsuna Arjunena. I was asked this very question by the warrior Arjuna, who was Vinashane, who was on the battlefield, the Mahabattlefield, Sapatnyaihi, with his opponents, with all the Kauravas, ready for battle. This very question was asked to me before, and then, I think we'll see just one more verse. Sri Krishna continues, Nyatva Nyativadham Garhyam, Nyatva Nyativadham Garhyam, Adharmam Rajahetukam, Adharmam Rajahetukam, Tato Nivritto Hantaham, Tato Nivritto Hantaham, Ato Yamiti Laukikaha, Ato Iti. I'm smiling because in one verse, Sri Krishna manages to summarize chapters 1 and 2 of the entire Bhagavad Gita. He kind of gives you the, we call it backstory. So the question was not asked until chapter 10. Here we get a little backstory of the Bhagavad Gita about Arjuna. Arjuna knew that Jnati Vadham, the Vadha, the killing of your Jnati, Sambandha, your relatives. The killing of your relatives is Garhyam. It's despicable. It's horrible. And Arjuna knew fighting against his relatives was terrible. Remember, all those Kauravas, they were family members, cousins. Can you imagine fighting? Actually, some of you can imagine. You ever have sometime when there's a will and the probate to be done? Sometimes there's fighting within families. That happens. But even in court, no one gets killed in a courtroom. No one dies. On the battlefield of the Mahabharata, hundreds of thousands of warriors lost their lives. So it's fighting against your cousins at a whole different level. It's a fight to the death. And that Jnati Vadham is Garhyam. To kill your relatives is terror, is Garhyam Adharmam. It is horrible adharma. Horrible adharma. And there's a very interesting qualification here. Because if killing your relatives is adharma, why did Sri Krishna say, fight? Uttishta Kaunteya, get up and fight. And a lot of people have this very question. How could Sri Krishna possibly tell Arjuna to fight and kill his own family members, his beloved guru, family guru, Drona and Kripacharya? How could Sri Krishna possibly tell him to do that? And the answer Sri Krishna gives here in one word, it is a dharma when it is Raja Hetukam. When it is done for the sake, when it is done for the sake of Rajya, regaining the kingdom. And this is a subtle but important point. You might remember, if you've studied here, the chapter 1 of the Bhagavad Gita, we've gone over this in great detail, was Arjuna truly fighting for the sake of regaining the kingdom? And allow me to just spend a few, since it's a common question, allow me just a few minutes to make this point very clear. He was not fighting for the sake of the kingdom. It's like a country going to war for the sake of oil. Happens, right? Countries go to war for the sake of oil, natural resources, And in the next 100 years, countries will go to war for the sake of water. There's going to be horrible water shortages in many places in the world in the coming decades, and chances are it will lead to warfare over water. So if we can fight wars over water, over oil, over all kinds of ridiculous reasons, what about Arjuna's fighting for the sake of regaining a kingdom which was unrightfully taken away from him? Remember the dice game. I'm not going to tell the whole story, but allow me to tell just one part of the story. And that was, before the war began, Yudhishthira sent Sri Krishna as an emissary to go and negotiate with the Kauravas. And in those negotiations, Sri Krishna first said, why don't we just split the kingdom in two? You take your half, they'll take their half. They had one half was Indraprastha, the other was Kandanaprastha, if I remember the language correctly. So they're going to split the kingdom in two. And this was put forward as a proposal to Duryodhana. Duryodhana was not in any mood to negotiate. He wasn't in any mood for anything. He's a really nasty kind of person. So he says, no way. Why should I give up half the kingdom? I have the whole kingdom now. Why should I give up half? And then Sri Krishna says, well, if you won't give up half the kingdom, then why not you let them have a portion of the kingdom having five villages? Just five villages. There are five brothers. Each brother can have their own village. And Duryodhana said no. Refused the proposal. Sri Krishna, trying hard to negotiate to avoid the war, said, well, if you won't give them part of the kingdom with five villages, why not you give them one village with five houses? They can each have their own house. Duryodhana said no. Well, if you won't give them five houses, why don't you give them one house with five rooms? Finally, Duryodhana said, I won't give them 5 inches. I won't give them anything. Now, the point of telling you this story, many of you know this story. The point of telling you this is, was Arjuna really fighting for the kingdom? If they were willing to negotiate away, in negotiations, they're willing to give up the kingdom. It was not a battle for real estate, as many wars are. What was the problem? The problem is the kingdom was being ruled by Dhritarashtra, who was under the thumb of Duryodhana, and the people of the kingdom were suffering terribly because of the corrupt leadership. People were suffering because of the adharmic leadership, adharmic rule over their country. So properly understood, this was a battle to restore dharma. It was not a battle to regain Rajya, the kingdom. It was a battle to restore dharma, which is why it's called Dharma Yuddha, which now gets conflated, gets misunderstood. Dharma Yuddha, righteous war, then some people say righteous war. Well, that's like jihad. It's a religious war. Sri Krishna is telling Arjuna to go and fight. This is Arjuna's jihad. Some people talk like that. They misunderstand. And I admit, if you really have to study the text pretty carefully to get it's a really complicated story, lots of nuances. And this is one nuance that really gets overlooked. It was not a battle over real estate. It was a battle to restore dharma. So with that in mind, and that's what Sri Krishna says, that jnati killing your relatives is garhyam adharmam, is terrible adharma when it is raja hetukam, when it is for the sake of regaining the kingdom. And again, this is, by the way, summarizing most of chapter 1 right there. And now I'll summarize. Chapter 1 concludes. Tataha nivrittaha. How does chapter 1 end? Arjuna sat down in his chariot, throwing down his arrows and bow, not willing to fight. Sri Krishna summarizes that. Tataha nivrittaha. Then Arjuna gave up. That's what it says. Tataha, then, nivrittaha. Arjuna gave up. And Arjuna said, and this is very prominent in the beginning of chapter 2, Arjuna says, hanta aham. I would be the hanta, the killer of my own family members. And further, hataha, I am. These family members of mine will be hatam. They will be killed. This is what leads to Sri Krishna's opening teaching in chapter 2, where he says, no one gets killed, nor is anyone a killer, because Atma, the truth of every person, is unborn, uncreated, can't be killed, can't be hurt, can't be wet, can't be dried out by the wind, can't be scorched by fire. So these are some very important teachings that come right at the beginning of chapter 2, which Sri Krishna here is giving us, really chapter 1 and the first half of chapter 2, he's given us here in this one verse. Lalkitaha. This is how Arjuna thought. Arjuna thought that he would be the agent of killing his family members. He thought that they would die on that battlefield, ignoring the fact that each one of his family members is an embodiment of Atma, the immortal self. And then, of course, Sri Krishna went on teaching and teaching and teaching for the next 17 chapters. And here, this is just to introduce Sri Krishna's narration. We'll stop here because with the next verse is a good place to begin our next class. It's where Sri Krishna will begin to narrate his vibhutis, his divine glories. And we'll see that in our next class. A couple of quick announcements here. Tomorrow is our Upadesha Sahasri, our Vedanta class at 10 o'clock. And then I mentioned before, we're shifting our satsang from morning to evening so we can sit outside. Evening sitting out underneath the trees is just lovely. Come and join us at 6 p.m. We'll sit outside. Of course, if it's raining, we'll come inside. But most evenings, it's really delightful. I look forward to it each year. So come and join us for satsang tomorrow. Also, we have some gardening projects that we'll do immediately after class, and they have some tasty food ready to share with you. I think it's food left over from the anniversary celebration. So if you can, stay back to help with some gardening projects, and then you can enjoy a nice lunch together. We'll conclude with our prayers. Om Gananahantva Ganapatigam Havamahe Kavingavinam Upamashravastamam Jeshtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanaspatahana Shrenvan Utabhisvira Sarinam Om Mahaganapataye Namaha Ishvaro Gururhatmethi Murti Bheda Vibhagine Vyoma Vadyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsachanuramar jagat guru